Hello, greetings and salutations. Welcome back and thank you for tuning in to another episode of Quantum Conversations. On this podcast, I like to explore a wide variety of topics and ideas, and as always, consider the angles that might go overlooked, are not taken into consideration, get conveniently omitted, intentionally redacted, or forgotten. Today is a continuation of our previous episode, where my guest and I look at symbols and mythological beings, how these have been co-opted, though some might say hijacked, by brand names, organizations, and even political movements. We'll also explore the ancient origins of these symbols and mythological figures so that we can better understand their truer meanings and the long-standing imprint that these have had on our collective consciousness. By asking questions, being curious, and not letting pre-existing biases hamper us, we can actually get past rigid or limited paradigms and step into one which alchemizes, engages, and maybe even uplifts us. It's not about trying to prove anything. It's not about squaring the circle or vice versa. It's simply an openness to see things differently. So, on that note, and without any further ado, let's jump right in. And joining me once again is my friend Shannon.
Hello, Nisha.
Hello, and I'm so glad that you're able to make it back for a part two.
Thank you very much. Again, happy to be here and chat about something I love.
Indeed. So, last time, we had quite the lengthy but also very engaging conversation last time, didn't we?
We did indeed. It went down several rabbit holes.
Several. And I think we ended up talking for quite a bit longer than we had anticipated. So this is why we're doing a part two, a part deux, people. And so last time I think we left off with Medusa. We left poor Medusa hanging. but maybe we should just quickly recap some of the things that we talked about. So we started off with...
I think I told one of the origin stories of Medusa.
Before Medusa.
Oh, Nike swoosh?
Yeah, we started off even before Nike. We started off talking about the...
Siren of Starbucks.
Yes, the siren, which is not a siren of Starbucks. Yeah, so we talked about the Melusine. Then we talked about Nike.
We did. And then, oh, Versace.
Versace and the Medusa. that sounds like a film. Versace and the Medusa. serious mode again. So, last time we explored and reviewed some or certain mythological figures and the legends and stories behind them, and how many big brand names and well-known companies end up co-opting the symbolism that is related to said mythological figures. So I wanted to kind of pick up from there and unpeel some more layers, if you will.
The iconography onion will be unfolded and peeled back.
Indeed. So, where would you like to start?
Well, I think because we left a cliffhanger on Medusa, maybe we could just do a little recap about her. I think everybody knows who she is, and that sadly most depictions of her in art are of her headless, because mm-hmm. it's the defeat of the monster, the Gorgon. Mm-hmm. Is it Gorgon? No.
Gorgon.
Gorgon, yeah. Listeners would benefit from just looking at some of the artwork in relation to Medusa, in that it's so prolific, and I think that's why she exists in our culture today. She was depicted and illustrated over and over by great artists, you know, going back how many years? Centuries, absolutely. Centuries. She's still used in, you know, modern pop culture. I think she's, you know, in several video games. She's prolific in terms of a symbol. So, she's a depiction of an iconic monster, isn't she? And she is, you know, but for me, Medusa is a tragic, tragic tale. It's not like, yeah, they chopped her head off. Perseus chopped her head off.
Yeah.
For me, it's more like, that is so sad. And I have so much compassion for her.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that we touched upon there being another origin story whereby, and you might be able to tell me a little bit more, tell the listeners a little bit more, and that there's an origin story where she's actually born that way, whereas the one I know is that she was turned into this creature.
Yes. So the Medusa figure we're most familiar with comes from the Roman poet Ovid and his epic prose Metamorphoses, not to be confused with Franz Kafka's The Metamorphoses. And so what we have here is a retelling of this Greek mythology, but with the Roman pantheon of gods and goddesses, which mostly line up with the Greek counterparts, right? So with the Ovidian tract, we have this sort of familiar lineup of the three sisters, Steno, Eurydale, and Medusa. And again, it's just worth mentioning that the name Medusa means guardian or protector. And I think that's worth remembering because it is an aspect that does tend to get overlooked. You know, the meaning of Medusa's name and the power that that actually generates or has generated, particularly in terms of her iconography.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't know whether Versace knew that or not.
No, we don't know. I mean, what we do know, though, is that her iconography, as we've mentioned, is so prolific. And more recently, for example, there was a full restoration done on the floors of a Roman Odeon or amphitheater in the former ancient Greek town of Kybria, which is now in modern-day Turkey. And anyway, the floors of this Odeon are just absolutely amazingly modern looking. You know, they're just, it's this multicolored marble of the Medusa. And it's absolutely stunning. And again, just a testament to how powerful her imagery has been.
Well, she's such an eye-catching visage, isn't she? Mm-hmm. I mean, I love looking at pictures of Medusa myself. In fact, I've created hundreds of Medusa images using my own illustration techniques, but also that new thing called AI art generation, which is so fun.
Yeah, I'm sure you can go down many a rabbit warren there.
She's just, I mean, she's beautiful.
And also frightening, and which is what she's meant to be, right? This combination of being both monstrous and sort of alluring.
Mm. And I think there's this thing in the human consciousness where if it is a female that's horrendous and monstrous and scary, it is more shocking. It's just more shocking, which I think also lends to the fact of why she is so iconic even today.
Yeah. So just to do a quick recap, just to go back again to the Ovidian version, that's the Roman retelling of the Greek mythology, just so that, you know, we can circle back. Again, we have that familiarity of the three sisters, two mortal, one immortal, the latter being Medusa. And unlike the earlier Greek accounts, in this one, Medusa is beautiful, and she's referred to as a priestess. And as the story goes, Neptune, aka Poseidon, is enamored by her and then proceeds to violate her in Minerva's temple, aka Athena's temple. So Athena's reaction to all of this is that rather than pursuing and punishing the perpetrator of this horrible violation, she punishes poor Medusa and then casts this terrible transformation on her and makes it so that whoever casts their eyes upon her would turn to stone. In the older Greek versions, particularly in the Hesiod tracts in Theogony, he describes the Gorgon sisters as already being monstrous, you know, with all the fangs and serpentine hair, etc., and all three sisters having had that same power that Medusa had. In other words, turning would-be onlookers into stone. And then in both versions, the story remains more or less the same, where we know Perseus is sent on this quest by the usurper king Polydectes, who happens to be his stepfather, because he married his mother Danae. And he's on this quest in lieu of a wedding gift, which the king thinks Perseus is going to fail at, but of course he doesn't. And the other thing we mentioned in the previous episode is that Medusa's side of the story is virtually unknown. So in many ways, she's depicted as just sort of this two-dimensional character. So in terms of the mythology, Medusa's death serves to ensure Perseus as the hero, and then simultaneously it empowers and protects him from his enemies and would-be enemies as he journeys back home. And at the same time, when Medusa's killed, her spilled blood produces two offspring, the first being Pegasus and the other is Cryosaur, a demigod who wields a golden sword. Not much is known about him. But so Medusa, despite her death, continues to embody this tremendous power.
That was a good recap.
Yeah. Thank you.
So yeah, she is, in both stories, she's just a fascinating figure and the classic femme fatale. And again, for me, the overarching theme here is that, you know, female monsters are always far more heinous than the male. And yes, that kind of phoenix rebirthing from the fire in terms of her death in the, you know, the Perseus killing rendition of the story. She births two children. That's not in the film. But yes, her legacy continues in, you know, more kind creatures that are born of her. I don't really know the ins and outs of that version. But she, I think to most people, she doesn't represent a regenerative kind of transform. Well, she is definitely transformational, but in terms of having powers of protection and big paws, protection and, let's say, a more positive outlook. I don't think that's definitely not well known.
Oh, but I think it's pretty strongly implied. I mean, Medusa's head serves first as a protective trophy for Perseus and then is eventually given over to Athena, the very goddess responsible for her monstrous transformation, who in turn reconfigures Medusa's head into an aegis, sometimes depicted as a breastplate and sometimes as a shield. And she uses that to scare and further protect her from her enemies. So this is pretty full circle. And again, you know, Medusa's name means guardian or protector.
Yeah. And Perseus kills the Kraken with the head of Medusa on the cliff. You know, he holds her head up and that, you know, 100-foot tall sea monster who was unleashed by Poseidon is turned to stone and crumbles into the ocean.
Yeah. That's why I'm saying, you know, this is this protective power.
Yeah, you're right. I'd forgotten about that. I'd forgotten about that part. But of course, I'm only recalling the actual film that I saw. So no, but that, yeah, she saves the day.
Yeah, exactly. Through her death, Medusa saves the day. And she also has two offspring, Pegasus and Cryosaur. And I don't think this is in the film, because as per usual, Hollywood has this incredible capacity for rejiggering things and claiming authenticity to the original or original versions. But anyway, I think that in the film version, Perseus comes flying on a Pegasus as he sets out to find and kill Medusa.
Yes, that's right.
And I thought, well, that doesn't happen until after Medusa's death. But, you know, that is Hollywood for you. They'll just scramble things quite a bit. But yeah, even through her death, not only is she a protector, but she has the capacity to give birth.
Yeah. Yeah, it is good. It's a great tale.
Yeah. So then we have this idea of a monster being a protector or guardian. And I was thinking, of course, this is something that we see also, for example, with churches and gargoyles. And this idea of sort of demonic-like or scary figures on the outside of a building, a sacred building, and protecting and guarding and casting away any evil doing.
Yeah. So the classic gargoyles, I think we mentioned this in the first episode, those classic gargoyles are there to protect from the evil spirits and pagans and heathens and snake worshipping people.
Yes. A shout out to snake people that we know, snake bros.
Snakes.
Snakes.
Yes, so the gargoyle, you know, comes into many, again, the logos of the gargoyle can be like full of that kind of clown characteristic or, you know, really quite horrendously frightening. But normally they're quite high up. They're not directly in the face of the person walking through the threshold of sacred said place. So no, it's wonderful. I mean, it would be great to see more female gargoyles because I can't really put my finger on any one that stands out as a female. But, you know, again, females are devout in their faith and innocent and pure in all respects. There's no duality in the female.
It was a very convenient sort of recreation so that women could remain chaste and seen but not heard.
Yes, yes. We must all be sublimated, indeed, and sit quietly doing our crocheting in the corner.
You crocheting a Medusa there?
Oh, yeah. Great idea. We love you, Medusa.
So, yes, we're all in. The other thing about the gargoyle, which is interesting, and as you brought up, this is a pagan carryover, right? From the Middle Ages onwards, we're used to seeing gargoyles sort of on the outside of church buildings, but not only church buildings. But anyway, traditionally, the gargoyle was either a serpent or a dragon, often winged. And the word gargoyle is also where we get the word gargle from, because originally these were spouts, right? And they would have just not strictly had an ornamental function to them in terms, and, you know, maybe they did represent shooing away of evil spirits, but they would have had quite a practical function to them as well.
Yeah, they serve as the drain pipe off the roof line most of the time. And in Britain and all over Europe, the dragon is often seen in more of the Gothic churches. And they're beautiful. And the irony is that, you know, there's a huge part of the Christian faith, you know, that wants to stamp out the serpent. Mary is often depicted with her foot keeping the serpent down. And then that links to St. Patrick, who wanted to dispel all serpent worshippers out of Ireland, hence why we have St. Patrick's Day, and because he got rid of all the heathens, pagans. And yet the crossover into Christianity and bringing that symbolism from the older pre-Christian cultures back in, and even today, my local cathedral has two giant dragons underneath two angels and the Christ figure on the cross there. So it's like, make up your mind.
Yeah. And I would also say that the dragon has sort of a dualistic nature, at least in the way it's depicted, because it's on the one hand seen as sinister, you know, associations with sort of Satan or the devil. And then on the other hand, it also this alchemical being and can also be seen as a protector. So I think very often the way that a dragon is depicted also depended on who commissioned the church, because not everything was commissioned by the Vatican. You had, of course, local bishops, you had the nobility, the rising merchant classes, and they all wanted to incorporate their bit in there. And I think what's interesting in particular about the gargoyles is that early on, they were usually just dragons or serpents or winged serpents. And then later, there was this sort of incorporation of local lore. This might have included spirits or demons or even certain individuals that were maybe well known in the town, in the area, for reasons that weren't always clear to us, but they were incorporated as gargoyles in these churches. And I think you were talking about your local church where you had these two. Did you say they were serpents or dragons?
They are dragons.
Dragons.
Symmetrically placed under Jesus himself.
That's really fascinating.
It's awesome.
Yeah. I think we also have a tendency of having a very specific notion of what the so-called Dark Ages or the Middle Ages were like. And I think what tends to get overlooked is that actually a lot of people still hung on to their old pagan beliefs. And it was just sort of reincorporated into the mainstream religion, i.e. Christianity. So, and I think what happens is that once it was incorporated, it somehow became more acceptable. I think that's the primary thing.
Yeah, they were forced to co-opt the previous cultural narrative, weren't they? So that they could integrate with the people. And that's a really, really long story. But yeah, this symbology in, you know, particularly Europe, with the gargoyles. And I think you touched upon, they were sometimes caricatures of people in the village. So there's a medieval church in a town in England where they're hilarious faces. They're not even scary. They're all jesters, you know, comedy faces. And apparently the lore is that they're based on people that the stonemasons knew. So it's just strange.
It is. It's really funny. And also, it's also really prevalent because you do see it throughout Europe, not just on churches, but also on many public buildings. And in certain cases, you see it like the heads of various nobility, generally important figures, as well as, you know, the VIP of the time, right, being depicted. And you could just see these builders had a great sense of humor, and they would, you know, also include the heads of various characters, some of them being, you know, infamous local characters. And it would just sort of be like, oh, well, here is the head of our local town crazy. You know, just the guy that tried to burn half the town down.
contraindicated, you know, symbolism that's either erroneous or, you know, when I was talking about the two dragons, I was thinking about the caduceus. So that is the perfect place to segue into the caduceus or caduceus or however you want to call it. So for the listeners, Nusha and I are going to explore the difference between the caduceus, which is the double serpented symbol that entwines the rod, the winged rod, compared to the rod of Asclepius, or however you want to say that, which is widely known as the symbol to associate the medical and pharmaceutical industries. So we're going to look at that. So the fact that these serpents are just so prolific throughout the symbolism of everyday life is amazing. So yeah, we're gonna have a little bit of a dive into the caduceus and the rod of Asclepius.
Indeed. And also, I was going to, because you mentioned the pharmaceutical industries, but it's also important to add that the older pharmaceutical logo had indeed a serpent, but it included yet another variation of this, and we'll get into that and all the various meanings. But I don't know, did you want to start first?
Yeah, so the caduceus is the double serpent symbol. Again, another symbol that maybe was erroneously co-opted in 1902 by some bigwig at the U.S. Medical Corps, and decided that that would be their logo to go on the uniforms and the copy paper and whatever they had back then in 1902. Whereas I am unclear whether he just got it completely wrong in that the original rod of Asclepius, which is associated with Asclepius, who is the god of medicine, the first physician. And we're going back to 800 BCE. And he was the son of Apollo, and apparently mentored and taught by a very wise old centaur, but who knows? So basically, when we see this medical symbol, it's the single rod. And this is the correct and official emblem of the American Medical Association and other medical associations throughout. It not exclusive to the Americans. So yeah, there's a little bit of crossover, and we're going to kind of look at the meanings behind these two symbols. It's all very fascinating. Again, we're sticking with the serpentine theme here, Nusha. And yeah, it's where do you want to go with this?
So one of the things that can be confusing is that there is the rod of Asclepius, which, like you said, is either referred to as the god of healing, or in his mortal form is a hero physician. And then we have the caduceus, which is associated with the god Hermes. And this is sometimes interchanged with Mercury, Mercury being the Roman equivalent of Hermes. So there's a lot of overlaps between these two gods, but there are also some clear distinctions in terms of characteristics and attributes. Very often, when we refer to the double coiled snakes around the rod or staff, which, as you mentioned, was co-opted by the U.S. Army Medical Corps, but it's really the rod of Asclepius that's the medical symbol or logo which is used internationally. So I thought we could look at the differences between those two symbols and the two mythologies, and once again, look at how they have been co-opted by the medical world, and also then by extension, the pharmaceutical world. So yeah, did you want to just go ahead and jump right in there?
Sure. So Asclepius, however you want to say it. In fact, I've got something written down here, and sometimes you find it as Asclepius. There's like at least four or five different ways of spelling this name. We know him as the first physician, and the story of him is, again, there are two lines of literary kind of origins and who he was and what he was. So there's some tales that say that he was an actual god because he was a son of Apollo. And then there's other stories where he was an actual man. And there was a whole cult that worshipped him. And he had this huge school where only special people can go. I think it was an island, actually, a Greek island, where only the special people could go to learn his magic and power. But ultimately, in the more Greek tragic tale, because they're always tragic, aren't they, Nyusha?
Always tragic.
Always. So despite there being healing temples and, like I say, schools that carry on his traditions and his knowledge and information, he was killed by Zeus.
As per usual.
As per usual, people. So, and the reason why Zeus cast a lightning bolt down onto this poor physician was that he healed too many people, and the population of the underworld was diminishing so rapidly that Zeus was just like, this can't be. We need like an influx of people coming down into Hades because Hades is getting mad. So I know you're my grandson, but
he seems to do that with people he cares about, including like Prometheus, right? Prometheus was supposed to be the one that he had favored. Look at how he treated him. Not a good ending.
So he was killed because he was too good at his job. You know, jealousy, you know, all the kind of themes of the pantheon just repeat themselves over and over again. But yeah, so he was struck down by lightning and he was no more in that tale. But again, there's plenty of depictions and written stories where, you know, he was actually a documented man. So who knows? So of course there's going to be confusion because there's one rod, there's one olive branch, let's say, there's one stick with one serpent, and that is the rod of Asclepius. And his symbolism has been passed on hundreds of years to what we have now, and it's the medical association. It's a brand, it's a logo. And again, comparing it to the Caduceus or the staff of Hermes or the staff of Mercury. But there is comparable symbology there, of course, because there always is, because when you have one serpent and you have two serpents, then there's always going to be crossover.
Yeah. So I think the other thing that's also important in terms of the story of Asclepius or Asclepius is that he had several daughters, all of whom are embodied deities of well-being, healing, the healing process, sanitation, etc. Right. So Hygieia being the most famous one. And then there's also Panacea, the goddess of universal remedies. And if you look at Hygieia, she's the goddess of health and cleanliness. And obviously that's where we derive the word hygiene from. And then Panacea is something we still refer to as an all-healing remedy, sometimes though as a miracle cure, contextually, though there's this sort of idea that that's not really viable or possible. So then there's also Iasso, the goddess of recuperation from illness or recovery from injury. And in the ancient and even not so ancient times, good health and well-being included the right kind of nourishment, physical activity outside, getting sunshine, swimming, having a steam. So all of these things were considered important in, you know, both the Greek and Roman cultures, as making you sort of a whole person and a good participant in society. So it's interesting that these goddesses, whose attributes are about physical well-being and cleanliness and remedies, etc., which are supposed to be sort of integral to a holistic healing approach, strangely in modern medicine have sort of been paved over as if these things were sort of more recently discovered and somehow
1,000 years worth of understanding about health and well-being. I'm not saying that it was perfect or that it didn't have flaws, but that somehow this just didn't have any consideration or merit or value. And it seems that most people who enter the professional world don't even have an understanding about that history. And if it's covered, it just sort of seems like a footnote or an aside. In fact, there was an article written, I'm going to pull it up right here, one moment, please. There was an article he published in 2015 about the fact that most students who enter medical school don't learn about the caduceus, don't have an understanding of the Hippocratic Oath that they take, and don't have an understanding about the philosophy behind these mythological figures. So all that has become conveniently forgotten. So I was just going to add that bit as well into the things that get overlooked or redacted or omitted.
Yeah. Well, we don't want any of that hocus pocus nonsense, do we? So because it's science-based now. It's not based on herbal plant home remedies like snake venom. I'm sure snake venom is a viable pharmaceutical still in modern science and modern medical terms. But and again, the symbology behind serpents is far and wide, and it goes so well with the medical industry, because think about a snake. It regenerates in that it sheds its skin. It is known for its healing powers in terms of its venom. And sorry, I didn't check, listeners, but I'm sure it must be used today. And then there's the oldest medical document that we have in modern times was an Egyptian papyrus, and it outlined the worm theory. And they think that this is how the snake became the emblem of holistic well-being and the medical field. So this guinea worm was a parasite, and the Egyptians cured this parasite from people using the venom of a snake. And I don't know which snake. So it's, you know, there's a lot of theories behind how this Egyptian worm, you know, became the serpent. And in ancient Celtic myth, serpents were often called worms. That was the Celtic word for them, worms, dragons, worms.
Yeah. And also the interesting thing is that, yes, you were talking about venom, snake venom. Snake venom is used in everything from, it's used as an antidote, and it's also used in, well, it's a botulin, so it's also used particularly in the cosmetic surgery world. So I don't know whether they still use it, but traditionally when people and predominantly women got Botoxed, what they would get injected with is a synthetic variant of a snake venom, because it acts, yeah.
Wow. Nusha knows a lot of stuff.
Random things. I know random things.
So the snake, you know, we associate serpent snakes with longevity, immortality. I mean, the list goes on and on. It really does. And, you know, and yet the duality of the snake is that, you know, it's also a feared, many people have snake phobias, even though they've never even seen a snake in real life. It's fascinating. It's almost like it literally is in the structure of our DNA. And our, you know, look at the caduceus. It looks like DNA. The duality, the balance.
So when you say DNA, like as in the double helix, the double helix that we usually associate with sort of the building block, protein building block of our DNA. Yeah.
Right.
It is absolutely fascinating. Yeah. But again, if you see that image of the single snake around the rod, so as in the rod of Asclepius, or you see two intertwined snakes around the staff of Hermes or the caduceus. And by the way, it just occurred to me that the general assertion has been around the US Medical Army Corps adopting the caduceus, that this was a misunderstanding or, you know, it was just done out of ignorance. But I'm wondering whether maybe it was something else, because if you think about the fact that the main purpose of the U.S. Medical Army is to tend to wounded soldiers, right, or to tend to the wounded in general in battle. And in the main mythology around Hermes's staff, it's that he used that to break up a deadly combat between two serpents, right? So the caduceus then becomes like the symbol of neutrality, of peacekeeping. I mean, I don't know, that theory might be a reach, but it was just a thought. Anyway, so what I really wanted to say was that Hermes is this god with numerous attributes, including transformation, wisdom, and healing. He's got this alchemical component to him. Whereas Asclepius was a medicine healing god or a mortal physician healing hero, depending on what point in history you refer to him in the mythology. And it's also really interesting that venom is both a poison, but the antidote as well. So if you are bitten by a snake, what you usually get as an antidote is venom.
Right. So that's the polarity right there. It's the unity, the polarity, the joining together, the balance. And I did read something that said that most people found the caduceus more appealing to the eye and more aesthetically pleasing in that it has balance, whereas the rod of Asclepius, beautiful as it is, doesn't quite have aesthetically, visually that balance. And I get that. I prefer the symmetry because my whole world is based upon, you know, the duality of the world that we live in, basically, which leads you back to Hermes, in that he was associated with the god of alchemy. And then the caduceus itself, the golden rod represents earth. It's not past tense, sorry. And the two snakes, one snake was fire and one snake was water. You know, the movement and the power of the fire and the water put together. And then the wings on the caduceus, of course, were air.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about the two serpents, and this might seem like a bit of a stretch, but what if one snake represents mortality and then the other one immortality? And snakes, obviously, they shed their skin, so there's a sense of renewal and an idea of why, you know, the snake is such a powerful symbol and why it would have entered early on before, you know, there was any kind of medical association as this alchemical, eternal, healing symbol. And once upon a time, medicine was also known as physic, without an S, because it treated the whole physical body, the person and their environment. So there's this connection with the physical realm. And then the other interesting thing is that Hermes, or Mercury, is connected to the zodiac sign of Gemini. And if you look at the constellation of Gemini, you have the twin brothers, Castor and Pollux, right? And Castor is mortal and Pollux is immortal, I believe. And despite that, these two are so close that when Castor is killed, Pollux gives up his chance to live forever on Mount Olympus so that he can be with his brother. And the two are then turned into the two brightest stars in the constellation of Gemini. So these two are symbolic of, again, the sense of unity, duality, death and immortality. And all of that is sort of connected to this ability to alchemize. So I think there's just this wild correlation there.
It is wild. It is wild. So, you know, you have the yin and the yang, you have the masculine and the feminine. So one snake being masculine and one being feminine, you then have fertility and the equilibrium. I mean, it just goes on and on. And then, of course, we need to separate the Egyptian Hermes as well. And that's where Hermetic tradition is born. But fact checkers, please, you know, you can yell at me. I don't care. but again, you know, this idea of the Caduceus and then the Greek and the Roman and the Hermes and the Mercury. So the attributes of Hermes are far more kind, in my opinion, anyway. He is about growth, harmony, wisdom, knowledge. He's about rebirth. And yeah, he is also the messenger, and he's the god of travel, and he's the god of writing as well, in Egyptian mythology. Anyway, so yeah, and then you have Mercury, who definitely is associated with commerce, merchants, travelers, jesters, you know, the cosmic joker, thievery and theft, which then you think, is it a nefarious conspiracy that the U.S. Army Medical Corps hijacked the Caduceus? Even though it was also, Mercury is also associated with eloquence in the higher diplomatic kind of realm of people. So I think, yeah, so it's, you know, there are crossovers. And although, you know, the Caduceus maybe have been co-opted, for me, it's still a beautiful symbol.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And also, it's interesting, the other component to Mercury is also that in its being mercurial, it's highly adaptable. It is very much an alchemical symbol of adaptation. We also refer to Mercury as quicksilver. And it's interesting that Mercury was traditionally used to gauge temperatures, right? You had your thermometer, the old school thermometers had mercury in them.
Yeah, and that's a great example of polarity in Hermetic tradition, in that hot and cold are just different degrees of the same thing, which brings them together. So that, it, you know, when we're looking at temperature, and Mercury signifies that. Also, highly toxic people.
That's the other thing I was going to say. You know, so long as it was in the glass, it was okay. But once that thing broke, you didn't want to touch it.
Absolutely.
The other thing that I was also going to say is that when we look at the symbol of the Caduceus, and you had already hinted upon that earlier, is we're looking at a symbol that goes back significantly by millennia, and most notably with the Egyptians, and Thoth being sort of the Egyptian version of Hermes or Mercury, right? Again, and then of course that co-option that inevitably occurs when, you know, cultures intertwine and meet each other. So you do have that component.
Yeah. So, and think about all the cultures around the whole world who revere the serpent and the snake for healing powers. I mean, that's a whole other episode again, Nusha.
Yes, for sure. For sure. And so I also wanted to just include briefly the other component of a logos being sort of incorporated in the health world, which is the goddess Hygieia or Hygieia, the daughter of Asclepius. And again, we have these root words, right? H-Y-G, Hyge, is the Greek etymology of this is health, whereas hydr or hydro, as we know, hydro in English is water. And then we have hygro, which is sort of very similar, wetness or moisture. So we have the goddess Hygieia, and her logo was a bowl and a snake wrapped around a bowl. When we look at the bowl, we can think of a pestle and mortar and creating healing medicine. And it was incorporated as the first pharmaceutical logo back in France in 1796. So before we had sort of the typical cross that we're aware of that sort of represents pharmacies worldwide, we see that green cross, so we instantly know that it's a pharmacy. Traditionally, it was a bowl or some kind of deep dish, not a dish, maybe more like a
vessel.
Yeah, bowl, vessel, that's the word I was looking for. A vessel, and then a snake wrapped around that. So again, this symbol, this pervasive symbol was for apothecaries and pharmacies. And it's so interesting also that we've lost the word apothecary.
Mm.
You know, we think of it as sort of somewhere where you go just to get some crushed herbs, lavender, you know, your essential oils. But there was no distinction between that idea of chemistry, going to an apothecary.
Mm. Natural philosophy.
Exactly. Right. So again, you have this incorporated ancient symbol being used as a logo in nearly all modern medical related things. And yet so many who actually work within those fields, or within that field rather, seem to be completely unaware of its origins and or any of the meanings behind the symbol. And that does seem very deliberate. I think another area where you can see, you know, the symbolism of a tree branch or staff with a serpent coiled around it is in some of the ancient Sumerian and Mesopotamian cultures, and also in Genesis, right? The Garden of Eden with the Tree of Knowledge and the classic depiction of the snake coiled around the Tree of Knowledge.
Oh, you're going to deep dive big time, Nuccia. And by the way, you might want to visit Nuccia's apothecary. Actually, it doesn't exist yet. It does in her mind. And in my mind.
In my mind, yeah. I think it's interesting that both in Genesis, but also in the Mesopotamian and Sumerian tradition, and even then when you look at later on in the Nordic tradition, they all have the tree of life, right? Or the tree of knowledge, the tree of wisdom, the tree of everything, right? And this tree, again, it kind of goes back to duality, right? It can give you life or it can give you death. And it can give you all of the knowledge that you need to become sort of the best person, right? The better version of yourself and gain that wisdom and insight. Or it can create destruction, right? You have all that knowledge for the purpose of destruction. And in that, you always have, there's always this idea of a snake incorporated in it in terms of ancient culture. So like, for example, in the Mesopotamian culture, there's this god of the tree of wisdom. And he's known as, and I'm going to butcher the name. So I think it's Ningxinzida.
That's perfect.
Oh, thank you. And he's often depicted as a large serpent, sometimes with a man's head, or as a man crowned with snakes around his head, where the snakes actually stem from behind his shoulders. And that's kind of interesting because that's a bit of a Medusa recall there.
Perfect man.
Shannon's perfect man. And the idea of the snake, the serpent wrapped around the good tree and the tree of knowledge, you know, the tree of wisdom, the tree of life. So again, it's just, you know, it seems to be, as you said, the shape of the DNA, it's embedded in our collective memory and in our collective understanding of something.
Yeah. And don't forget in Genesis, even though the narrative is that the serpent was evil and, you know, correlated with Satan later on, actually the serpent was the one who told the truth. And it was Yahweh who didn't tell the truth. Just saying, people.
You will have to go into like another episode where you clarify who Yahweh is.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, in the Old Testament, Yahweh is God.
Right.
Yeah.
Lots of smiting and smoting.
So much. And yeah. Yes, indeed.
Indeed.
So, Nuccia.
Yes.
When you mentioned a green cross or a red cross, if you're talking about, blood, mm-hmm. usually uses the red cross and the green cross, because a cross doesn't have much symbology that we could go into at all, or would it segue into our next topic?
Yes, it would. That was very clever of you. But I did want to bring up one more thing before we went there.
What? Tell me.
Which is the interesting thing is that we've basically been talking about serpents galore. And what I wanted to say, though, is that in reference to all of this being connected to the world of medicine, there's been this oddity regarding the Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah.
Which is the key bit, because when students who are about to embark on their medical journey or become doctors, rather, take the Hippocratic Oath, and yes, you know, there are variations of it, right? But when they take the Hippocratic Oath, the original Hippocratic Oath is, and hang on, I'm going to pull this up. So just bear with me for just 1 second. Sorry.
Named after
Hippocrates.
Thank you. I was, you know, entertaining the listeners while you were fact checking.
Go ahead. Entertain the listeners. So, the Hippocratic Oath comes from the Greek physician Hippocrates or Hippocrates, which is the oath that many medical students take in the world when they are inducted as doctors. And it begins with, I swear by Apollo Healer and by Asclepius, by Hygieia and by Panacea, and by all the gods and goddesses, making them my witness that I will carry out, according to my ability and judgment, this oath and this indenture. And so this is the beginning of the Hippocratic Oath. And then it goes on with language that is clearly of the time, but it also includes this line, which is, into whatsoever house I enter, I will enter to help the sick, and I will abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm, especially from abusing the bodies of man and woman. So.
It's a shame they're all murderers, though.
Well, no, Hygieia wasn't.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Asclepius wasn't.
I beg your pardon. Apollo was a big murderer.
Apollo was an issue. I mean, he was problematic, but apparently he was also a healer, so who knows? But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that in many places they've removed this component, and in yet in other places, including in India, I believe, they still use the original Hippocratic Oath and swear by all the gods. And I believe in a number of places in the UK, they still do, and in some parts of the US, but in other countries, there's either a variant of this or this part has been eliminated. And in some places,
Say that one more time. In India, they use the Greek pantheon, not their own pantheon?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there may have been in India, at the medical schools or university, I think there may have been a legislative proposal a few years back to substitute it with something more culturally aligned. But I don't know if anything ever became of it. So, yeah, as far as I know, the Hippocratic Oath is, yeah, it's...
I bet that the Indian medical field, the whole field is probably co-opted by Britain and America anyway, you know, in terms of what you learn.
For sure. If they're studying
pharmaceutical companies, that's what I meant to say.
Yeah. And I mean, there are many medical schools in the world that no longer use the Hippocratic Oath or even any oath. But in those places that do, even if part of it seems archaic, the oath still holds a kind of ethical and moral implication. And it's also worth noting because, you know, one of the aspects connected to medical students taking the Hippocratic Oath or a variant of it is for physicians to do no harm.
What?
Long pause.
Long pause.
Long pause. So, yeah, And you know what else is really interesting, Shannon, is that earlier we mentioned the Green Cross as a symbol for pharmacies, and you talked about the Red Cross as a symbol for donating blood, and sort of tying this together with our next topic, as well as what we just talked about regarding the Hippocratic Oath. Did you know that there is a medieval Greek manuscript of the Hippocratic Oath in the shape of a Coptic cross?
Wow.
That's really awesome. Really cool. So, segueing into this next topic, Shannon, this is the most controversial of our topics. And it's really not once we unpack it, I think. But when most people hear the word swastika, what do you think they're thinking?
Do I have to say it?
Yes, okay. Please.
It's the symbol of the former Nazi party.
Correct. It has a very nefarious kind of connotation.
Sadly.
But when you think of the word swastika, what do you think of?
My heart fills with joy because I know it as an auspicious antediluvian symbol of most cultures around the world. And by antediluvian, I mean before the flood, so prehistory. A Paleolithic, in fact, goes back to the oldest known depiction of the swastika, which is a Sanskrit word, by the way.
Exactly.
Is from a 15,000-year-old ivory-carved bird with the swastika symbol on. So obviously, then that was in what is now the Ukraine. So obviously, whatever culture that was, it was called the Mazin culture. Whatever culture that was, I don't really know much about it, but they obviously didn't use that Hindu word, the Sanskrit word. So for me, it's a globally recognized symbol of happiness. Well, we're going to go into what it symbolizes. But for me, it's happiness. It's an auspicious symbol. It represents prosperity, well-being in all ways, best wishes for all.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially, again, another like truly universal symbol that predates by thousands and ten thousands of years.
Yeah.
Than the co-option of the Third Reich, the Nazi Party, and it is found and pretty much embedded in everything, from everyday objects to buildings. And it has a very, again, I think a very celestial connection. And as you were saying, the funny thing is we use the word swastika around, and I think a lot of people erroneously, very erroneously, think that it's a German word, and it's not. And it is widely used in Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and throughout South and Southeast Asia. Whereas I think in the West, for so long, and for reasons that we can understand because of the atrocities that we attribute to it, collectively, we've completely forgotten its ancient positive connotations. And I think once more people realize that this is a truly universal ancient symbol, a symbol that got instead co-opted and corrupted, then, you know, I think that it sort of necessitates revisiting and realizing that so much of our history has been either, you know, erased or reframed or simply not taught. So that even when we see a swastika outside of the usual World War II related context, we cannot imagine that it's, you know, means anything other than what we know it to be, and that we have that sort of immediate collective response to it, that it must be something horrible and dark and sinister. And I mean, I used to have that reaction too, because I assumed that this was the only meaning. And it took to encountering the symbol in a totally different setting to realize that, perhaps there's just maybe more than one meaning to it. And the other thing is that there's this notion that the actual word swastika is universally used by all cultures around the world. And that's simply not correct. And the first time I remember coming across it outside of the usual context was when I was in Italy and I saw them as mosaic patterns on the floor of a Roman villa. And I thought, that's odd. It's odd to see the swastikas there. But obviously, you know, that predates by several millennia, sort of the more recent connotations
we have
the baton with that back symbol. To you if you want to jump right in there.
The four-pronged baton. No, absolutely. I mean, everything you said is truth. It's like you can have 10 vessels that hold 10 truths and they're all truthful. And the swastika definitely goes into 10 of those bowls for sure. So in Vedic tradition, again, the Sanskrit word is from the root sui or swasti, which means good. And asati, which is to exist or all that is or it is, and basically translates to may good prevail for all. But in Vedic tradition, it has a complex multidimensional meaning as well. So it is the basis for Vedic mathematics. It is seen as a portal into the fourth dimension. It obviously has four prongs, so it obviously is the sacred four directions. And it's, I believe, I might be wrong, but sometimes it has six prongs for the six sacred directions. So northeast, southwest, above and below. But it's multi-layered, it's multifaceted symbol, again, antediluvian in nature. It is omnicultural. And I know Nusha mentioned some of the cultures that we have found this symbol being used, you know, from Africa, obviously India, the ancient Orient, the Hittites, the Norse, the Celts, the Greeks.
The Pueblo people, the Navajo,
yeah.
The
predominantly, Duni, the Hopi. Predominantly the mm-hmm. Navajo. And in Navajo, that symbol was called the whirling logs for them. And you see it in their art and their tapestry and their textiles and their pottery. In all of their art forms, you see that symbol. But it was also linking it to the medical profession. It was used as a healing sacred rite. So I hope that, you know, listeners out there have seen sand art, you know, the unbelievable sand art using sand of different colors to create these mandalas. So these would be created using different color sands to create a picture on the ground. And this would be used in a healing ceremony where this swastika in all its glory and beauty would be created. And then once that healing rite, you know, and the chants and the prayers that went along with it, then it would be destroyed. And, you know, circling back to all creation and destruction are just a polarity of the same thing. You like life and death. Yin and yang. We're going around in full circle, Nusha, which is, you know, the sacred circle of the swastika.
Yeah. And also you know, you were talking about the polarity. So traditionally in more, I would say this is more typical of the Vedic, Hindu, and to an extension also the Buddhist traditions, you would have the inverted version of the swastika to symbolize the shadow aspects, the Kali
yeah.
sort of lessons and dharma that come with it. Interestingly enough, that doesn't really exist in some of the other cultures because you can see the direction of the swastika going either way and not having the same connotation. So again, you know, we had talked about this also just a couple of days ago about sort of looking at Navajo weaving and textiles and the whirling log and seeing that having been a prevalent symbol in their weaving and in their rug making. And likewise amongst tribal people, everywhere from the Black Sea to through the Middle East, and then all the way to Afghanistan, you know, and these are two cultures that apparently never met. I know, it's shocking, apparently. You know, they never met historically, as far as we know. But we might be proven wrong, because history and culture and anthropology should be an evolving thing and not fixed, right? So you see that symbol being used time and time again throughout the world and throughout the ages. And I'm not saying this to negate how it was nefariously used in more recent history. That's not, I think, at all what we're talking about here. But what we are doing is, you know, acknowledging that this is a symbol that predates by several thousand years the more recent connotations that have been attached to it, and why it's important that we allow cultures throughout the world to be able to reclaim their connection and their meaning to this symbol. Because I do feel that, you know, hanging on to it as just being something solely nefarious gives it power.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, in the 19th and 20th centuries, the swastika, again, before the rise of Nazism, didn't have that negative connotation and was used throughout much of Europe, including the UK, usually on buildings as ornamentation. And in the United States, as late as the mid-1930s, the swastika, or probably the influence was from the Navajo whirling logs, it could be found everywhere, from billboard ads for fruit to playing cards to even supposedly Coca-Cola charms, like key charms. So apparently even some US Army planes from the 1920s and 30s had swastikas on them, and supposedly completely unrelated to the Nazi Party. So,
wow.
Which is, again, something that you wouldn't really normally read about or know.
Because it was a good luck charm.
Yeah, it was a good luck charm.
Wow. Well, it's a shame that it got lost the way it did. But I think we're, you know, and with podcasts like this, I think it's coming back. I've spoken to a few people recently who are well aware of the ubiquitous nature of that symbol. And, you know, if you want a deep dive, just... you can see that the symbol represents a whole philosophy of Vedic traditions, in that it represented the fourfold aspect of your divine nature. So each prong, let's say, was associated with a different set of gods and goddesses. I mean, it is absolutely a beautiful, beautiful symbol. So hopefully we're making a dent in that narrative. So the other thing that it also represented multiculturally across cultures was that it was often associated with a huge comet, a cosmic physical body, which brought destruction and apparently brought that global flood. It was so the duality of that is, again, the life and death and the destruction of this comet or this cosmic body in the sky. And it also could represent the sun, you know, the sun with its rays. So it is so multidimensional and multifaceted. But again, it's balance. It's, you know, those four sacred directions. It is a beautiful thing, and we should absolutely embrace it.
Yeah, and you know, you also mentioned the cosmic component, and there have been observations made by some that the seasonal transitions of Ursa Major, aka the Big Dipper, aka the Big Bear, around the North Star, aka Polaris, when this moves through all four equinoxes, so i.e. winter, spring, summer, and autumn, takes on the form of the swastika when it's depicted or when it's charted out.
Which could be the theory of why it was omnicultural around the globe before people apparently had boats, but, you know, that's another podcast. No,
yeah.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really fascinating, and it deserves broader public consideration as a symbol with a very long-standing anthrocultural tradition, and that this really kind of goes to prehistory. And I think you were talking about the mezzine figurine of the bird, where there's this sort of pattern that looks very much like a swastika on there. And I believe I read somewhere that, in fact, they've dated this to be as old as 17,000 years old.
Well, I mean, it's flipping old, Nusha. You know, and the good thing is, when you think about the population of the globe, despite what happened in World War II, most people on the planet still associate this symbol with something prosperous and auspicious.
Yeah.
So that is the good news. It's us here in the West just need to catch up a little bit.
Yeah, certainly. And I also feel really bad for cultures throughout the world, especially since they had nothing to do with the horrors of World War II, for whom this symbol was, you know, as we've said, sacred and auspicious. And we talked about the Navajo and how they were strongly discouraged from being able to use the image of the whirling logs during and even after World War II, which, you know, on the one hand, you can understand, but something that is a part of their tradition and a part of their culture, you know, in many cases, they were told that if they used it, that they wouldn't have the right to sell or trade.
As if they hadn't had enough crap already.
Exactly. Yeah. Insult to injury.
Yeah. They actually did try, after World War II was over, they did try to rename a little town populated by native peoples. They tried to rename it Swastika, and the people didn't want them to, because it was still too soon.
Yeah, they should have stuck to whirling logs. It might have been might have worked better.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It might have worked better.
Yeah, I mean, I have often thought it would be so lovely to have a tattoo. But yeah, no. I'm not ready to just put up with what that could bring, you know, in terms of my sacred journey, which is what the Hopis associated that symbol with, you know, the many stories of the Hopi, but they wanted to spread in the four directions of the known world. And that was their symbol for the sacred directions and where their people went. And the idea was that they would all come back together and regroup one day. So,
And there's also this whirling of the cosmos.
Yeah.
You know, there's the idea of the whirling of the cosmos. And when you slow it down, you can see these four whirling branches, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
It's also interesting in your neck of the woods, but it's not quite in your neck of the woods. But I believe in place called Ilkley Moor in West Yorkshire. There is something known as the swastika stone, which is supposedly about 2,000 years old.
Older.
Yeah, older, probably.
Yeah.
2,000 is probably a conservative estimate. But we can say probably around the Neolithic period.
Yeah. Yeah, there's several stone. There's a lot of art up there carved into stone. And that is probably the most famous one. But I think it's in a spiral form. It's more of a spiral. And again, could be the cosmos. But, you know, we know the spiral is, again, one of those symbols that is just, it's within our DNA. You know, it's in our human consciousness. And again, you know, the swastika could deep dive for the rest of your life just in terms of the sacred geometry aspect of this symbol and its mathematical qualities, like, you know, documented in the Vedic manuscripts as well. It's balance. It's the epitome of balance.
It is quite ubiquitous.
And I
think it's just worth a discussion, and I certainly feel that at the very least, cultures that have had that embedded in their art, in their spiritual practice, in their own mythology, should be allowed to freely use it and incorporate it and celebrate it. And maybe slowly but surely, you know, as time passes, we in the West can look at this again and recognize the duality in that it had a legacy that was very dark, and yet predating that, and even after that, it has this, again, very powerful and potentially healing symbol to it.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And again, you know, in that it's a symmetrical symbol, it's always going to represent the light and the dark, the shadow and the light, death and rebirth. These symmetrical symbols are just embedded in this idea, you know, and it, the fundamental structure of it is a cross. And again, you know, we mentioned earlier, that'll have to be another podcast How did we segued well with that, didn't we? From the medical symbol to the swastika to,
indeed.
Serpent
indeed.
And monster. Yeah, great.
Yeah, I feel like there again, we could just deep dive on just one of these for hours and hours. Yeah. Also because so much has been researched. But I think the biggest thing is really being able to bring this to the fore in a more common discussion and not make it seem like it's some kind of abstract, that it belongs on the fringe or just belongs for, you know, for people who are quote unquote interested. Yeah. Because I think the ultimate reality is that those symbols, and I'm not here specifically just talking about the swastika, but everything else that we talked about, those symbols are so readily co-opted by companies, by businesses, by international organizations. You look at symbols for the WHO, not our favorite, that has co-opted the Rod of Asclepius. And most people wouldn't, you know, would just kind of phase over them. So many international organizations have, and we don't connect to the meanings and the stories behind them. And I think that's really important, because when we don't have that, we do have a forgetting. We have a collective forgetting. Even though we go, I know this symbol from somewhere. So I think that's really the biggest thing, that we don't have a collective forgetting, and that this resurges, and that we do reconnect to the, even if some of the stories and mythologies are just, you know, for us in our modern context, a little bit, when we talk about, you know, poor Medusa, and when we talk about especially the Greek and Roman pantheon, or even the, you know, some of the other pantheons. So they can be so complex and confounding and a little bit odd, but it's still, I think, worth knowing. It's still worth understanding. And then going, that company may know nothing about the actual mythology, but they, somewhere in the recesses of their minds.
Absolutely. It's in our DNA. These symbols are in our DNA. I think there's actual parts of the brain that deal with just symbols, you know, and that collective amnesia is absolutely there. So if you, let's say we had 10 six-year-olds in the classroom and we showed them a picture of the Rod of Asclepius, and we said, what do you think this means? You know, we would get some absolutely amazing ideas and creative responses and expressions of, you know, their gut feelings on that. Hey, let's do that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I think if you show kids, in addition to the symbols, you also have a numeric component to it. You know, if we look at chakra, again, I feel like we could go into another, but if you look at chakras and the colors associated to chakras and the number of chakras, right? And then you see other spiritual practices where the chakra isn't there, but something similar is there. Same numbers. And also, interestingly enough, similar color spectrums.
Right. We're all just energy and frequency, people. So turn off your TVs just one night a week. Just one night a week. And find out something amazing.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, instead of doom scrolling, just honestly look up something new and go, I did not know that. I think that's the best. I love doing that when I go, let's find out more. And if you're like me and if you're like Shannon, next thing you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you haven't had dinner.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, is there anything else you wanted to add there? Because I can't think of anything else, but I feel like we've done a lot and yet we've only scratched the surface in terms of all of these topics.
Because we're not experts.
Topics that we've covered. No, by no
means.
We're not
experts. But I've thoroughly enjoyed the circle that we've made in these two episodes, Nusha. I've really enjoyed it, how, you know, they all interlink, they're all intertwined, they all can overlap and have this amazing, comparable, well, just this comparable over cultures and centuries and millennia. Just anyway, I've really enjoyed our discussions. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, as have I. And I feel like this is something that we can revisit and maybe also look at more things next time and maybe just concentrate on one and really, really deep dive. Because again, it is food for thought. It is really engaging. And I feel like I don't quite know how to put this that in a way that I feel really will justify, but I feel like it is so important to connect with our past, especially the past that is often suppressed or considered just woo-woo or considered unimportant by whom. I don't know who decides that what's important, what's not, in terms of, but particularly in terms of, you know, our educational framework. Because when you think about what, when you're young, what kids are really interested in, and you begin talking about mythology, I know very few kids that go, oh, yeah, I'm not interested in that. At a young age, that's the most fascinating thing that you can learn about. And then when you see that it ties in with almost every field, astronomy, physics, medicine, the arts,
chemistry,
literature, chemistry, religion, everything. You know, there's this connection with symbolism and mythology. And it is a way of connecting to our ancestral past. And it doesn't matter where you're from. Mm. It doesn't matter where you live.
Yeah.
That this has been so sort of, and so much has been lost, you know, for various reasons, whether it's empires crumbling or raids or the erasure of certain parts of history due to whether we're looking at the church, but it's not just in Christianity.
Today. It's happening today.
It's happening today. It doesn't matter whether it's Christianity or in Islam, yeah. You know, you have the destruction of the old to replace a new ideology, but it doesn't ever get truly destroyed, right? You have fragments that are there. And those fragments to me are the fascinating bits. When you were talking earlier about there being a cult dedicated to Asclepius,
yes.
And I thought, I was like, oh, maybe that was like the first mystery school, you know?
Ooh. Yeah, no, it's like a big puzzle to undo, take apart, put back together, find new pieces. Life is fun.
Yeah, and it's meant to be the one where we're constantly learning more about ourselves and our interconnectedness.
Yeah.
And I feel like this again could be another episode, but our bigger purpose and our bigger purpose in life is not to eat, sleep, rave, repeat. Yeah. That's not the purpose.
What? Wait, what?
Did I just say something to startle you?
Well, doesn't quantum physics say that everything is connected?
Everything is connected.
Everything is connected because it's all energy.
Absolutely. And that's like yet another topic we can dive into. But we'll save it for the next time, shall we? Yeah.
Stay curious. Right. Stay curious, Nyusha.
Stay curious, Shannon. All right. That's all, folks. Thank you again so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoy diving into this topic. If you have any suggestions on other symbols, mythological figures, or indeed any other topics, feel free to send an email. You'll find the contact details in the description box, or follow Quantum Conversations on Twitter, aka X, at Convos Quantum. Again, that's at Convos Quantum, and let me know. In the meantime, stay curious and Godspeed.